Crossing the Book Cave, and I'm joined here with Art Simple and Paul Spiteri. Okay, somewhere like that. Sorry about that, Paul.
It's okay.
And we're going to talk about the Wold Newton universe and try to explain it to me about what it all is and what it isn't. Who wants to start on it? You know, what it is.
Well, I could kick in a little. The Wold Newton universe was really an idea that Philip Jose Farmer proposed in his book Tarzan Alive back in 1971. He was attempting to create a family tree that would relate several of the characters of heroic fiction together, primarily Tarzan of the Apes and Doc Savage, but he also included people like Sherlock Holmes and George Edward Challenger and other characters. And what he postulated was that all of these characters who basically had a – they were of a British or a French abstraction, that there had been a meteor that had fallen in Wold Newton in 1795. Wold Newton is a little town up in Yorkshire in England. And that it had been witnessed when it landed – by two coachloads of people who included a variety of figures who were ancestral to various heroic characters. Primarily, I don't have the exact list of people there, but, there were there was a Lecoq there, there were Claytons, people who were relatives of Tarzan and a variety of others. And the idea was that somehow the radiation from the falling meteor had influenced these people, and from that point onward, their descendants would have various increased, enhanced capabilities. Now, this was not only just for heroic characters. He also included a couple of the villains as well, people like Professor Moriarty and Captain Nemo. The idea behind this was to try and create a literary universe that united characters from various types of fiction centered around some of the heroic characters that Phil himself really loved, the pulpish characters, but then also including characters from other types of literature that Phil also appreciated. I mean, he included people from Pride and Prejudice. There are also included some people from the plays of George Bernard Shaw and a variety of others. And what Phil tried to do was to create a plausible family tree involving all of these very interesting characters. Some of these characters were clearly historical characters, and some of them were semi-historical characters, fictional characters, whatever. It was an interesting idea, and it really captured my imagination when he first did it, because this was a way of taking all these different figures and linking them together. And for one thing, it gave a certain depth to these heroic characters that they had not had before. It linked them directly to historical events and to other people. And there's nothing quite like having a character set in a particular family setting. It gives them a history. I think it fleshes them out and fulfills them more as full-fledged, well-developed characters. One of the things this did for me, way back in, 71, I was all of... Oh, gosh, I can't even admit it. I was like 19 years old at the time. And one of the things that the Wold Newton tree did for me was to get me interested again in different types of fiction. I was very strongly into science fiction and the emerging pulp resurgence that had gone on at that time. But by following Phil's Wold Newton universe, I started to look back at some of the other stories, the Jules Verne stories, the H.G. Wells stories, other types of fiction, the different detective characters as well, because he included in this people like Travis McGee and Lou Archer, Sam Spade, who was the hero from The Maltese Falcon, that people remember Humphrey Bogart for portraying in the movies. And for me, this was a gateway back into literature. Literature that I had not appreciated or had not read. I'd heard about it, but I started to get back into reading it. And I think that it really was an important event in my life to start doing this and getting involved more in a wider reading program that I was able to kind of link together with my fun reading. At that time it was kind of serendipitous. I had only just read the Tarzan series a couple of years earlier, and when Phil goes into his long detailed development on Tarzan, I was able to relate a lot of what he had written to the early Tarzan stories. And this also began the whole Will Newton thing began a period in Phil's literary oeuvre over the 1970s, where he started to pick up other themes and started to bring in some characters and pastiches involving other characters. And I think that it also broadened his own appeal, and it really presaged a lot of what he was going to do over the next 10 years. When Tarzan Alive first came out, I was absolutely enthralled, especially because of the connection that it made with the origin of Doc Savage. In Tarzan Alive, Phil Farmer had first postulated that Doc Savage's father, Clark Savage Sr., actually was the James Wilder from the Sherlock Holmes story, The Adventure of the Priory School. And I had read that story years earlier, and I had to go back and reread it again. And, that again reconnected several different characters together. And I waited, with bated breath for the next installment, which was going to be his Doc Savage biography, which came out 2 years later. And that further expanded the Will Newton tree to include other characters. Now Phil had made a number of suggestions in Tarzan Alive for connections between some of the different adventure characters. And at this time in the late 60s, early 70s, they had started reprinting the various pulp characters, including the Spider and the Shadow, along with Doc Savage and Tarzan and Fu Manchu. And these characters all figured prominently in the Will Newton tree. What was interesting is that initially Phil Farmer had postulated that the character of the Shadow and the Spider were actually the same person. And he got a large negative mailing about that, because there were people who were fans of both characters who complained that was not possible. And so when Doc Savage, his Apocalyptic Life, came out 2 years later, Phil amended this in order to have them as separate characters. And he also expanded the tree by at least mentioning the Richard Henry Benson, who was the Avenger, another pulp character who had just started to be reprinted about 2 years earlier. So, the whole Walt Newton idea has caught on. Paul and I were talking about this earlier. Diverse people like Alan Moore, for example, have used the Walt Newton framework for some of their more recent work. The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, in one way or another, owes itself, at least partially in conception, to ideas that Phil Farmer had given before. And, for me, it's just been it's been a fun thing and an educational thing, and I've spent many an idle hour trying to figure these things out and going through books and looking for clues to who could connect to whom. I've made some postulates of my own about this, and our friend and colleague Wynne Eckert has really been the guru of the Will Newton universe and the guardian of orthodoxy. And I've been shot down a couple of times on proposals I've made. And in retrospect, rightly so, Wynne had his eye out for the continuity, and he's done a very good job of this. In fact, he has an entire website that you can get to off of www.pjfarmer.com. There are actually three Wold Newton sites that are listed on there. One of those Wold Newton sites is Wynne Eckert's. There's another one that belongs to Dennis Powers, and there's a third one as well, which I'm blanking on who does that third one. Do you remember who the third one?
No, I don't, Art. I'm just having a quick look, see if I could spot it. But no, the two that I'm particularly aware of are Wynne's and Dennis's, because I think they hold the number one and number two slot in terms of time on the web and certainly in their completeness.
Absolutely.
And, yeah, it's... go on.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, over on Wynn's site, there's actually a picture of the meteor that is crashing. And you see a coach and a coachman and horses, you know, and the horses is, you know, being spooked by the meteor. I didn't realize this, but this actually was done by Wynn's wife, Lisa. Lisa Eckert actually did that drawing.
Yes, she did. Yeah.
So this has been for Wynn, this has been a family thing.
Yeah, and, you know, I think Wynn's knowledge on this subject is phenomenal, really. And I know, and I think Art alluded to it, that people... you know, try to make connections and do make connections in the Wold Newton universe. And Wynn's the guy who I think would give it the yay or nay and prove that it fits into the continuity and that it could have happened and, you know, fits in. But just to add a little bit to, I think, what Art was saying about the history of the Wold Newton family and the universe, I think when we talk about the Wold Newton family, we talk about the people who were there at the time the meteor landed. Mm-hmm. And I think Phil hints in his work that these people were special anyway, and that the meteor brought something extra out in them. And by that, people who actually predate the landing of the meteor can sometimes be described as being part of the Wold Newton family. And, you know, these genes were there, ready to benefit from this meteor and take them to a next level. And, you know, it's those people that were there at the meteor and their direct descendants are the family, and the universe kind of expands out from that and goes further. And to me, one of the greatest additions to the Wold Newton family is Spock in Star Trek, because, you know, and that's based on a comment that Spock makes a couple of times, even notably in the most recent film, that whatever, once you've excluded everything that's impossible, whatever remains is the truth. And right. I think in the series, he actually says one of his ancestors said that. So there's a thought that Spock is actually descended from Sherlock Holmes, from his human side. So, and it's that kind of investigation and linking that I think makes the whole Wold Newton universe and family so fascinating and just so interesting.
Well, I happen to be on the site right now that's by Wynn. And I was looking at the different ones, like, you know, they say popular characters that Philip was a Farmer included were members of the Wold Newton. And they say, you know, like Professor Moriarty, and in parentheses, a.k.a. Captain Nemo. So, is he saying that they're the same person, or?
Yes.
Yeah. This was something that Phil Farmer had proposed. He had an article in the Baker Street Journal that was published a long, long time ago, back in the I think it was the late 1960s, and it was republished as an appendix. I think it's in The Other Log of Phileas Fogg.
Right? I think you're right. I know you're right. Yes, you are.
Yeah. Yeah. Where he defends this. You know, in The Other Log of Phileas Fogg, this is a Phil Farmer novel which tells the real story of what happened during Jules Verne's novel was Around the World in 80 Days.
Right.
And it's an interesting extension of the story. It also brings in the idea of the Eridanians and the Capellans, two alien races that are at war somewhere out there, and somehow they had some of their representatives have crashed on Earth and have secret societies that are continuing this battle amongst them. And I've often wondered, because, of course, Spock comes from 40 Eridani. That's the star system that Vulcan allegedly exists around, which is only about 8 light years from here. And I've often wondered whether this was an early battle between the Vulcans and some other race. You know, we have all kinds of suggestions for who the Capellans could have been. You know, it's possible that it could have been some offshoot of the Klingons. Who knows? I often wonder whether Phil Farmer might have been toying with that idea.
Interesting.
Yeah. I remember reading one of the old Star Trek novels where they had Spock kind of go back into time onto Earth. And we remember that TV series that had Bobby Sherman in it, Seven Brides, or...
Oh, Seven Brides for Seven Brothers?
Yeah, or I don't know if it was called that or something like that, but Barbie Sharman. And the thing is that that story, I mean, those characters, Ishmael was the name of the novel. And it had, it kind of reminds me a little bit of that. Because, they throw that in there with it.
Yeah. I remember the TV show you're talking about. It starred Robert Bolt, and Robbie Sherman was one of the brothers, and they ran like a logging camp, and in order to get the land, the women that had come from the East had to marry the men, and none of them could leave. I remember that story. I wish I could remember the title of it, but it is something like that.
Robbie Sherman does the theme song.
Right.
I was a little kid when it came out. It's one of those things you just sort of click in your head. Then, of course, when they wrote that novel, it sort of, it's when you start talking. Now, when he's talking about, Moriarty, going back to Moriarty and Captain Nemo. Now, it's been years since I even had anything to do with the Captain Nemo stuff. Now, if I remember right, Nemo was during the time of the Civil War.
Right, approximately.
Around that, because he was kind of blown up ships on either side. And then, of course, you have Holmes is like 30 to 40 years later.
Right.
So, how old is Nemo supposed to be? You think of Nemo being probably close to my age.
I'm sure we're not really sure of Moriarty's mortality, because certainly in the Phileas Fogg novel by Phil Farmer, there is an extended life period that these people can live through.
And several characters in the Will Newton family are postulated to have this. Cagliostro is one of them. I forget, there's a female character also who supposedly has an elixir of life. They postulate the same thing for Hanoi Shan. And Hanoi Shan, who is the analog for Fu Manchu.
Okay.
And we know Fu Manchu had a secret elixir. That's the center of one of his stories, which is the daughter of Fu Manchu, I believe, is the one where that's important. But in any case, there's the... to really understand where Phil comes from this, because he does a very meticulous job of it, you really need to read his paper from the Baker Street Journal, which goes into some detail. Because, in fact, the mother in this case was a woman named Urania Moriarty, and she has three sons named James.
Okay.
According to the Will Newton story. And each of them has a part to play in the story. And, again, Phil goes into some detail on that in Tarzan Alive. But this, this was the Captain Nemo idea was an attempt to try and unite this character with some others. And, he did the same type of thing with the Shadow and the Spider, which didn't quite work out. But By doing this, he was trying to cut down on the number of really of characters and to try and enhance who they might have been. In order to really understand it, you do have to read the other log of Phileas Fogg, and that helps to explain some of where that's coming from and the reasoning behind it.
Yeah, good luck trying to find a lot of the older Farmer books.
Yeah, well, some of them are around. I of course have several of them. Unfortunately, some of these smaller ones were only in paperback, but I've got copies of them floating around that I've kept preserved just for this reason, because you got to have them. They're also, I'm hoping to see soon that we're going to get electronic versions of some of these seminal works. Right now, you are able, the only book that I've been able to find that you can get an electronic version of on Phil Farmer, Strange Relations is out. That's one of them, which includes The Lovers. And I think they have To Your Scattered Bodies Go, the first in the Riverworld series. But there are no official electronic transcriptions of his other novels.
No, I have the Green Odyssey is out there.
Green Odyssey, you're right.
Feast Unknown I've seen out. The first crossover with the Doc Savage Tarzan, or his versions.
Well, yeah, well, the Feast Unknown actually predates Tarzan Alive by 2 years. And that was actually the first book that I had read of Phil Farmer's, which was an interesting book to read,
yes.
Since it's controversial content. But it kind of starts, Phil gets started there in this idea of trying to unite the characters in a family, though he doesn't do the Wool Newton idea at that point. That comes with Tarzan Alive. But the when right now there are bootleg versions that are circulating around, and I think that's what we have with A Feast Unknown. You know, I was kind of surprised, but the follow on stories, the Mad Goblin and the Lord of the Trees, which was the two sequels to A Feast Unknown that were published as an Ace Double back in 1970. Those books were actually published in hardcover in the UK under different titles. The Secret of the Nine is one of them. I forget the other. And then there was an omnibus version, which was published in hardcover in England. And it just so happens I picked up both of those in a used bookstore in Alabama, of all places. I couldn't believe it when I saw it. These were Phil Farmer novels. And the title was wrong. You know, it wasn't the same titles, but as soon as I flipped through them, I realized the content was the same. So I've got copies of those. Those are somewhere up here in the library.
Yeah, I mean, Lord of the Trees, it was a 7 press edition, wasn't it? It was a hardcover. I don't know if you recall that art, but I think. I can picture the one that you mean.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And to me, it was interesting because it was never published in hardcover here in the United States. All we ever had were the soft cover versions.
I got lucky. I got the Ace Double myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to read that one. Now, kind of some of the oddball relations that DeWalt Newton has. Some I have no problem with. One is like G8. Now, isn't he supposed to be, he's from World War I. And then they say he's like, was he supposed to be the Shadow later on, or was he supposed to be the Spotter?
Initially, well, actually, it was supposed to be both of them. Initially, Farmer had postulated that G8, the Spider, and the Shadow were the same person.
Right.
And when these characters were being reprinted, they had their own fan base, and people started writing and complaining about it. And so in Doc Savage, His Apocalyptic Life, he identifies them as three separate characters that are actually slightly closely related to each other.
Huh.
But they're not the same person. And have you read G8's stuff?
I've read a few.
I haven't.
You've read a few? Haven't. Yeah, well, G8 was a World War I flying ace who was supposedly a special agent, so he went by the title G8. And he always had these fantastic menaces that he had to combat. You know, the dragon Staffel and the bat Staffel. And there'd be giant hands coming out of the sky crushing Spads and things like this. And he had about 300 of these adventures, and I wondered how they actually squeezed that into the 4 years of World War I.
Very busy.
And Phil Farmer actually postulated that really what was going on here were the psychotic ravings of some madman who had been driven mad by his exploits during the war. And that was his postulate in Tarzan Alive, and he kind of carries that idea on in the book The Peerless Peer, which was a small novelette that Phil had published back in the early 70s, which starred Sherlock Holmes, and actually it was post Doc Savage and Apocalyptic Life, so he had the three separate characters, the Shadow character, the Spider character, and the G8 character, all in that storyline. And very definitely, the G8 character was definitely out of his mind and seeing things.
Okay.
Phil had he had an awful lot of fun with that story.
I can see, you know, little bit I've read, I mean, him and Spider both.
Mm-hmm.
I can see going that way.
Yeah, the Spider was a little over the top. He had an awful lot of violence. He became a very popular character with the fans. I really have to admit, I never quite got into the Spider. You know, I enjoyed a few of the stories, but They were also kind of bloody and violent and a little bit over the top for me. I'm more of a Doc Savage fan myself, right, and some of the more moderate Tarzan stories. Now, when Phil actually went through, I have a copy of a French television program, the title of which is Moi Tarzan, which means I Tarzan. And this was done by a Belgian director. It's a French language program done by a Belgian director, in which there's an extended interview with Phil Farmer. Now, the interview is given with English with French subtitles. And Phil Farmer says in the book Tarzan Alive that there actually was a true life equivalent of Lord Greystoke, that he had been able to trace him down in Burke's Peerage. And he actually sat there during the interview with this big, thick book that was Burke's Peerage, and he has all these bookmarks in it showing where he had searched for this figure. And Phil claims that he actually had an interview with this gentleman in the early 70s, just before the publication of Tarzan Alive. Well, actually, yeah, it would be like 1969, 1970. And allegedly, Phil says that the man was planning to fake his own death because he was not aging and he did not want anybody to discover his secrets, and so he was going to disappear. But Phil was very serious about this. He really believed that the Tarzan character was a true historical character that he had identified, and he identifies the person supposedly in the book, Tarzan Alive. And I remember one time he does the same thing. He did the same thing for Doc Savage, believing that there actually was a James Clark Wildman. By the way, I got a hold of a Who's Who from the 1930s, and there were several Dr. Wildmans in there, including a James Clark Wildman, though his description didn't really match the Doc Savage description that we normally have. So there was somebody in the Who's Who from 1933, that that name was actually present here in the United States. Well, anyway, one time Phil was at a conference, and somebody said to him, "You sound like you really believe in Tarzan and Doc Savage." And Phil's comment was, "Well, you believe in Jesus, so what if I believe in Doc Savage?" You know. Phil took it. He took it very seriously. You know,
I know that it's kind of almost the same story, but I think. And maybe the thing you're alluding to, Art, but I know he was interviewed at his home once, and at the time he was being interviewed, his granddaughter was there, and Phil said something like, "You know, Santa Claus is coming soon. You believe in Santa, don't you, Kim?" And she said, "Of course, you know, you believe in Tarzan." So, you know, as far as she was concerned, everybody had their own belief systems.
Yeah.
Well, there's a couple others. I mean, I'm just kind of looking at the different names they have down here. And it's been years since I read the Doc Savage one. And if I remember right, wasn't Doc Savage and Monk supposed to be like cousins?
Yes. Monk Mayfair was a very brutish-looking fellow. He was kind of looked like a hairy red ape. And even back in A Feast Unknown, Farmer had postulated that he was the character who was the monk surrogate in the story, Jocko, was a relative of Dr. Rutherford. That the Rutherfords, there was an actual doctor, I think it was George Rutherford, who was a professor at Edinburgh University. And Dr. Rutherford had been one of the instructors for Arthur Conan Doyle. And he had been a very blustery Scotsman, who drank heavily and was prone to violence. And you know, not that we endorse stereotypes, but this was the character. And Arthur Conan Doyle supposedly based his character of George Edward Challenger from The Lost World and from a variety of other stories on this professor. And so in A Feast Unknown, it is mentioned that both Jocko and Doc Caliban, the Doc Savage surrogate in that story, were related to this Dr. Rutherford. Now, in fact, that's one of the prominent connections that we have on the family tree. So that connection actually predates the Tarzan Alive and the Wold Newton series. That goes back to the few years earlier.
And then, I just kind of flipping through here, different ones. Now, isn't it supposed to, like, mostly the pulp heroes are, like, in the universe, too, or?
Well, he tried to populate the universe with mostly the pulp heroes. You don't have – Farmer never connected into the comic world. This is something that has been controversial in Wold Newton, but it's received some support. You know, Wynn has been very reticent about it, but he's allowed a little bit of comic crossover. I think one thing that helped to spur that on was that in the Zarkon novels by Lynn Carter back in the 70s, Lynn Carter had in the beginning of those Zarkon novels, he would have various pulp hero characters coming together at the Cobalt Club and kibitzing before the action started. And every now and then a comic character would come in, like Batman, Bruce Wayne. So really, in the Wold Newton stories, the central portion of this was really popular fiction heroic characters. And, you know, we're talking Sherlock Holmes, Tarzan, Doc Savage, the Shadow, who is a little more peripheral in Tarzan Alive, and of course G8 and the Spider, but also people like Monsieur Lecoq, Arsène Lupin, and other characters. Now, he also extended it out, though, to other heroic fiction. You do have, for example, the Scarlet Pimpernel, who was a heroic character from the early 19th century. You also have the connection with Jack London's character from the Sea Wolf, Wolf Larsen. Now, Wolf Larsen is allegedly Doc Savage's grandfather. I think I got that right, yeah. So different characters from heroic fiction started to get pulled in. And then you had the characters from Pride and Prejudice, which is very much a mainstream type of novel, a Jane Austen novel. You also have other characters from, really not so much mainstream, but other literary characters are pulled into the storyline, too. There's a Dr. Caber is brought in, Carl Peterson. Some of the legendary characters, including Cagliostro, is also there. And there are several characters from the plays with George Bernard Shaw. I remember I was having a discussion online, and I mentioned the character Major Barbara as part of the Wold Newton universe, and to my surprise, Wynn didn't recognize the name, and I reminded him that Major Barbara was explicitly mentioned as a character in Tarzan Alive, and Wynn went back to check, and it was there. This is the title of a play that George Bernard Shaw did, which was a very interesting play on social morals and money and religion and moral obligation. And she's explicitly mentioned in there, as are a couple of other characters from the Shavian canon. So it's not just the pulp characters. It was the net was cast much wider than that.
Yeah, I was kind of noticing that some of the names they put in here, some on the comic-wise, I can see, like Batman and Robin and Captain America and Bucky, because they're still human.
Mm-hmm.
Still, Superman, I can see, say, the early version. Before became really to the point where he's, could do everything. Then, he had some other, Now, there's a couple of pulp heroes that I guess, unless you want to say they're an alternate universe, one would be like Operator Number 5. He can't fit.
No. Well, none of the storylines from Operator Number 5 would fit in the known universe. he's another character. Paul, are you familiar with that name of that character at all?
No, I'm not. No.
Well, Operator 5 was another secret agent type character. And in the 1930s, there was this extended series of stories on Operator Number 5 and a secret war. Well, actually, an open war that was going on in the United States with the Purple Empire. And there's all kinds of battles going on and people being killed. There's no possible way that could be included into the Wold Newton continuity. It was very much a fantasy story. And You know, I read a couple of those because they started reprinting all the pulp stuff once Doc Savage took off. And, you know, the stories were okay, but they were a little too far out for me. And what I thought was interesting is that they were stories that predated World War II, yet in some ways they were somewhat prophetic about some of the types of atrocities that occurred during the Second World War.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'd say, you know, but the thing is that it got to the point where the United States was taken over by the Purple Emperor.
Right.
So that's why I say that it could not be in the Will Newton. Then now there's a couple, as we talked about earlier before the recording, that has to do with one of my favorite characters, the Lone Ranger. Mm-hmm. And there's two different characters in there. First, we'll start off with the Dan Reed, as we was mentioning before, you know, as we talked before the recording. Now, I read somewhere, and it's been a while, and it's going to kind of, at first, turn me off a little bit on the Will Newton universe, is Dan Reed, who's the brother of the Lone Ranger. Both John Reed, who you later on you find out is a Lone Ranger, and Dan Reed, they're brothers, and along with some other Rangers, are killed to start off the Lone Ranger legend. And only the Lone Ranger, John Reed, is the one who survives. Well, according to somebody, I don't know who wrote it, but they say that Dan Reed digs himself out of his grave, staggers off, and meets some other guys, and they shoot him again. And he becomes, off the TV series, the Lazarus Man, who is played by Robert Urich. Mm-hmm. Then later on, he has no memory through the rest of his life, and he later on becomes like, he thinks he's James West from the Wild Wild West. Mm-hmm. And he just keeps on going through there, and the thing is that he never finds out he's Dan Reed. Now, the part I always had a problem with is that the Lazarus Man, from everything I could see of it, because they didn't really give you a whole lot of detail, I thought he was like at the very end during the assassination of Abraham Lincoln.
Right.
And everything I've seen and read of the Lone Ranger is like 10 years later where he becomes a Lone Ranger.
Yeah. Well, you know, the Lone Ranger actually doesn't fit into any of the original Will Newton chronologies. It's not in Tarzan Alive, and he's not also in the Doc Savage Apocalyptic Life. This is a character that had started out on the radio, and Phil kind of limited himself to literary characters. He didn't really get characters from comics or film or from the radio. He also, there were also other pulp characters. For example, Zorro would be another possible character that you might get connected to the Will Newton family that for one reason or another, Phil never connected the Zorro character in either. Now, different people, of course, have tried to make additions to right. the Will Newton family and postulated it. So I think probably that idea came from elsewhere. That, you know, that's a speculation that someone may have made. There are several different sites that talk about Will Newton connections, but you know, this is the reason why we have Brother Wynn over there in Colorado, you know, keeping tabs on things and making sure that the continuities all work.
Well, yeah, so another part of it, you know, the Lone Ranger one is that the Lone Ranger himself mm-hmm. becomes Briscoe County Senior. You know, which, you know, I was like, wait a second, that just didn't quite fit. I mean, the character and all.
Yeah, that doesn't fit the timing either.
And I mean, and plus the character himself. I mean, yeah, sure, he's a heroic marshal and all, but I don't really see the Lone Ranger, you know, yeah, sure, he's going to hang up his guns after a certain period, but he's not going to be doing a dual identity as, say, Briscoe County Senior and the Lone Ranger. Because it's really, he'd be doing the same thing over and over. You know, same character in the same way, in a, if you really look at it.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, you know, this is one of the fun things about the Will Newton universe is that you get to look at ways of connecting some of your favorite characters together with each other, and that way you make a much larger storyline than just a, you know, because sometimes the little storyline that you have with a favorite character is somewhat limited. When you can connect them into another storyline, it really expands them and gives them, I think, greater range and greater significance. But if we're going to take this idea seriously, and there are some of us who do take it very seriously, you really need to watch your continuity and make sure that what is proposed is plausible. You know, I know that, you know, I for one have been making Wold Newton type speculations for, it's 30 years now. More than that, it's because Wold Newton was, it's almost 40 years. My heavens, I hadn't thought about it. But it's been a long time. And you can run away with it. And, you know, when you do that, you kind of lose part of the fun of it, I think, too. It's interesting that you know, the original inspiration for trying to take fictional characters very seriously were the Baker Street Irregulars. This was a group that used to meet down in London. I think it's at the Sherlock Holmes pub that's right off of where Nelson's Column is. And it included some of the literary greats of the early 20th century, including Father Ronald Knox. And Father Knox was a biblical scholar, and he decided one time at a meeting to use some of the techniques that they use for critical biblical study and apply it to the Holmes canon to draw some conclusions. And this kind of got things started. That's how the Baker Street Journal got started. The Baker Street Journal was published, as last that I knew, it was published by Fordham University. It was the Jesuit university over in New York City. And that was the beginning of really taking fictional stories seriously. I remember when we had a recent controversy going on about the birthday of Doc Savage about a year and a half ago, because there is a story called The Perils in the North, which talks about Doc Savage, his birthday, the original canon, and it gives all the links to when Doc's birthday was going to be. And that story makes it very clear that Doc Savage is about to celebrate his birthday at the time of the midnight sun over Greenland. Now, if you're familiar with the midnight sun over Greenland, that happens only in the period between May and July. So that would have to make Doc Savage's birthday sometime in May. And if you look at it, there was an article in the Bronze Gazette where the author made the case that it had to be in that May time frame because of a variety of things, including this political commentary going on in the story. He centers it in May. There's only one problem with that. And the problem is, if you go back to the story of the Priory School, all of the events in the story of the Priory School occur in late May of 1901. And there's no question that it's 1901 because they talk about the days of the week and the number day in the month of May. And the only way that the days of the week and the numbers coincide with each other is either in 1901, 1895, or 1908. And the story was published in 1903. So obviously, it could, you know, the events had to have happened either in 1901 or in 1895, and 1895, for a variety of other reasons, is an untenable time period. So 1901 is the right time period. And that would mean that the wife of James Wilder was pregnant at that time, but she wasn't showing because nobody knew. That's an important part of the Wold Newton story, is that when James Wilder escapes and leaves England after the story of the Priory School, his wife eventually gives birth to a son, but nobody knew that she was pregnant. So that had to mean she's only about 3 months along. And I did a little piece on my Speculations in Bronze blog site about that. So what we have here is, very clearly, we have in the Perils in the North story, Doc Savage had to have a birthday in May, or somewhere in that range between May and July. But on the other side, he couldn't possibly have a birthday in May because, his mother would have to have been pregnant at that very time, and we know as a fact that she wasn't. And this was a big dilemma. How do you solve it? Well, the solution that I came up with very simply was that when Doc Savage was born, it was actually in November, as Phil Farmer had speculated, which would fit in well with the Priory School story. But when they returned to land and they registered the birth, they lied about it because they were trying to conceal their identity. And so Doc was a very large and precocious child who didn't look like he had been born in November. He was looked like he was several months older and much more advanced. And so they pushed his birthday back to May so that he would have been born around the time that everybody knew the Wilders were trying to escape from England. And she couldn't possibly have been pregnant at that time, so there would be no way to connect Doc to this the child that was being registered as being born with the Wilders. And as a consequence, Doc Savage has two birthdays.
The birthday on his... Like the British Queen, two birthdays.
She has two birthdays too?
Yep, absolutely.
I didn't know
one
that.
One official and one real. Yep.
Oh, I never knew that. What is her official? How do they fix the official birthday?
Oh, I know it's in June. I can't remember the full reasoning behind it, but she has a personal birthday and one which is celebrated with the country.
Amazing.
The Trooping of the Colour and all sorts of things. All so, that. Yeah, she has two birthdays.
I never connected that, even though I lived there for a while. But I said, you know, that's the solution to the problem is if you go back to the text, you can see this. And, you know, what?
So I was just going to say, I think that's the fascinating thing about the Walt Newton universe, that kind of investigation. You know, I've learned something today. I never appreciated that discrepancy in the Doc Savage birthday. And I think that's exactly the kind of work that people like Art and Wynne do to try and get this continuity right. And I think it's fascinating.
Well, I was kind of wondering, you know, while we're talking... if Fanful City Farmer was influenced by Edgar Rice Burroughs, if you read on his Tarzan and his Pellucidar, they cross over.
Oh, yeah.
And,
well, Phil Farmer had... There are several things in the Tarzan canon that Phil Farmer had taken exception to. There's a story called Tarzan and the Ant-Men, mm-hmm. where Tarzan is allegedly shrunk to be about 6 inches high by some witch doctor.
Right.
And Phil Farmer had no bones about going in and saying that this particular story must be fictional because it doesn't make any sense. He also objected to some of the timing with the son of Tarzan. Phil Farmer has postulated that the timing of the story would make it impossible for Tarzan's son to grow up and to be old enough to do the things he was doing at the time period when he would be doing them. You know, it's come. I don't know whether you have this over in England, Paul, but here in America on the soap operas,
right?
The children are sent away to school in Switzerland when they're 5 years old, and they come back in the next season and they're 25.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Half the time you'll see them as a baby.
Yeah.
And then next thing, they're young children. Then they're, you know, old enough to have kids of their own.
Yeah.
And it will happen in about 3, 4, 5 year period of time.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing. There's whatever this place is in Switzerland. These kids grow up fast.
I don't want to go there. I want more time, not less.
It's kind of
absolutely.
What's that one cartoon that came out? The Venture Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
You seen those? You guys seen them, man? Or a couple of the shows?
Yeah, I've seen them. Have you heard about those?
No, I don't think so.
It's kind of like a Johnny. It's kind of like a modern day Johnny Quest.
Okay, is that?
Okay. You know who I'm talking about on that, Paul?
No, I don't think I do.
Okay, back in the 1960s, the Hanna-Barbera cartoon people did a TV show called Johnny Quest with a young boy and his father who's a scientist. They go around the world having adventures, and they fight dinosaurs and all this stuff. And it was taken somewhat seriously. It had science fiction-y elements to it. They resurrected the series about 10 years ago for the Turner Broadcasting System for a short period of time. Now... The Cartoon Network has got what we call the Adult Swim over here in the United States. And these are cartoons. Yes, these are cartoons for adults. And the Venture Brothers are a spoof of the Johnny Quest type storyline. But what's interesting about them is that very clearly the Venture brothers are, their father is Dr. Venture, who is a great scientist, like Johnny Quest's father, Dr. Quest, was a great scientist. But it is very certain that the original Dr. Venture, the father of the Dr. Venture in the stories, was Doc Savage.
Right.
They can't actually say that because they don't have the rights to it. But anybody who is able to piece two and two together knows that that's who it's supposed to be. So this is supposed to be the third generation of Doc Savage's relatives. And, of course, it's a spoof. They're all crazy. There's an awful lot of very strange goings-on here. You have to really see this series to appreciate it. It's a lot of fun.
And, well, another thing is that, the point I was going to make was that Dr. Venture kind of created his own sons.
Yes.
And for, I haven't seen all the shows, but I haven't seen that one. It's like, oh, I should have fixed that in the planning stages.
Yeah. Well, see, what's happened is that his sons have this tendency to get themselves killed. So he has clones.
Oh, I see.
And so every time the sons get killed, he pulls out another clone and reactivates it.
Kind of like Kenny in South Park, then.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. I find it interesting. The Doc Savage character is actually a very well thought of character throughout heroic fiction. People are always doing pastiches, involving him in one way or another, little things here and there. And, the pulp characters are actually very well thought of by some of the writers. It always surprises me that, we haven't had more emulation of some of the pulp characters in the writing. But, nowadays there's been a resurgence of interest in the pulp characters, which... I think it's riding in on the coattails of a number of things, including the Wold Newton idea.
Well, speaking of the Wold Newton idea, I remember you and I talking about it, and you did a little something of your own on your Sunco.
Well, and, yes, it did.
And somebody who you find out is the daughter. Do you want to mention that, or do you want to kind of keep that sort of...
I gave you an exclusive on the show about that, and I can say it now, that in the Sun Ko character Sun Ko was actually a German pulp character being published around the same time that Doc Savage and the others were, and I've done a couple of short stories that have reimagined the character for a more modern audience, and. In the one story, in the first story, I do have Sun Ko seducing a British secret agent by the name of Felicity Knight, and it was my intention that this Felicity Knight actually becomes pregnant by Sun Ko, and her daughter Emma Knight eventually becomes the character we know as Emma Peel.
Now, Paul, you should recognize that name.
I certainly do. I used to love it.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I used to Diana Rigg. It always clutches my heart when I see Diana Rigg as she has aged. Gracefully though she has aged, I will always remember her as she was in 1968.
Paul, we can barely hear you now.
Oh, sorry. Is that better?
Yeah.
Yeah. There you go. That's good. But okay. But I that was one of the connections I'd done deliberately, and I've put a couple. I've done a couple of little pastiches on what I call the Loci comrades from World War One, and I've put a couple of the connections in there, Wold Newton-ish type connections. One character that still, for one reason or another, never fit into all of this was the Tom Swift character. Tom Swift was a very popular young adult character in literature back in the early part of the 20th century in America, and I kind of took the character and I've melded that character together with Long Tom Roberts. There actually is this, if you go and you put it out on the web, there actually is a family called the Swift-Roberts family.
Okay.
These are a couple of guys who came over from Scotland. And they worked together, and they traveled together down into the southern United States, and their families intermarried, and they were in an extended large group, the Smith Roberts. So the Swift Roberts, rather. So I've tried making that identification because, among other things, Long Tom Roberts is only in very few of the stories, and that's always interesting. Like, what's he doing in between? And I postulate that one of the things he's doing in between is he's having his own adventure, allegedly as Tom Swift, the inventor.
You know, stuff like that, I have no problem with. You know, things that that fit. But when you have other,
you got to work to make them fit too. You know,
I think so. I think that's that is part of the process. I think of the Walt Newton universe is trying to make it fit and trying to come up with a good plausible reason why it should fit.
Well, it's like, you know, that there kind of just slips in, just a perfect fit. Now you get, you know, the stuff like I was mentioning earlier, you know, the Dan Reed character. Mm-hmm. You know, trying to, and he's all of a sudden he's these other characters. That to me does not fit. You know, because, well, when Dan Reed is shot and killed, Tonto is not going to be burying somebody who is obviously dead. I mean, alive.
Yeah.
And as much as he's been shot, you know, I mean, if you look at the origin of the Lone Ranger, he was barely able to move around. I mean, Tonto had to take care of him for several days before he's up, you know, to actually start moving a little bit by himself.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, and to be perfectly honest, if somebody's not dead when you bury them, after they've been buried for a little while, they will be dead.
Oh yeah.
Especially if they've been shot.
And if, I mean, you being a doctor, you know about that. I mean.
Oh yeah. I mean, yeah, there were stories about people in Victorian times who had swooned away and awakened at their funeral, to the shock and horror of both of the person involved and the family. And we've postulated that that's one reason why a lot of people have insisted on getting folks embalmed.
Yeah. Make sure
they buried them.
But certainly there was a penchant for a time of having bells attached to tombstones so that
right.
If you were buried alive, you could ring a bell and be magically dug up.
Exactly.
That's probably where you see a lot of the origins of, like, the vampires and stuff like that, because, you know, people coming from the grave, you know, dead. Yeah.
And I believe that was, you know, graves being dug up after a certain time and finding people with blood pouring down their mouths. And I think that the explanation being that perhaps they were buried alive, and when they woke up in the grave, obviously, you know, their thrashing about created blood being poured down their mouth when they were dug up. People wondering that these people actually exited the grave. So I think, you know, there are all sorts of things happening that medical science couldn't allow for narcolepsy or whatever that perhaps meant that people were buried alive. I remember reading the story of a woman who ended up waking up two or three times on a mortuary slab 150 years ago. And you would have thought after the first time she would have taken some more precautions, but
yeah.
I mean, that's gonna, well, anything that's going to give you a heart attack is waking up on a mortuary slab.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, that will do it. Well, you know, that was an important plot point in one of Michael Crichton's novels, The Great Train Robber. Have you ever read that?
Is that the first Great Train Robber? Or
right?
Is it?
Yeah, it was The Great Train Robbery was the name. It was Michael Crichton,
right,
was the author. Yeah, and that was one of the points. The character had one of those little bells, and they were transporting him in order to bury him. And they wanted to, you know, they wanted to put their Confederate in to the car with what they wanted to rob, but they wanted to make sure that everybody knew that the guy in the coffin was dead. So they had their Confederate hide in the coffin with makeup on and actually ring the bell. When they opened the coffin, though, they could see that he was all made up to be putrefied, and they put a couple of dead cats in there with him, so the stench was abominable.
Was this set in Victorian times? Was this?
Yes.
Yeah, they filmed it, didn't they, with Sean Connery? I think
that's
it was
right.
Filmed as the first Great Train Robbery.
Yes,
I remember it well.
Yes, yeah. That was the one, and it was That was a great story. Michael Crichton, it was a shame that he passed away so young.
Yeah, it is. I didn't realise he'd written that story, to be honest. Interesting. I remember the film, and I loved it.
Oh, yeah, he'd be famous for doing the Jurassic Park. Or you don't think of somebody else? Yeah, Crichton.
Michael Crichton was famous for Jurassic Park, wasn't he? And ER.
Yes.
Timeline, his time.
Timeline was his. The Andromeda Strain was his first novel.
Right.
That was back in the early 60s. He did several of them, and he was one who also had, he had science fiction elements, but he tried to keep a hard science base to him. And he had, what his novels are some of the few that actually have footnotes in them with actual references to from literature. He did, what was the story that he did? He did several throwaway novels in the 70s that were fun. But, they made a movie out of his story, Eaters of the Dead. There's a movie with Antonio Banderas, and the movie was okay. Eaters of the Dead was a very well-done book. It had a little bit of Lovecraftian pastiche in it. It actually was intended to be a pastiche of Beowulf.
Okay.
The original horror story of all literature, and that was the way. And there's a quote from the Necronomicon in it. There's a whole bunch of other things, and I would say people may have seen the movie and said the story was all right, but the book is very different. I'd highly recommend it. It's a lot of fun.
Oh yeah, most of the books are really different from the movies. Yeah. Now of all the. Post-Farmer Walt Newton editions, which one would you say you had the most problem with that you've seen? That's somebody putting in that you kind of, like me with the Dan Reed.
Well, it depends. One of the things about the kind of speculation you do with Walt Newton is that part of it's the fun that you get from doing it.
Right.
There are a lot of authors who have tried to emulate Walt Newton by doing by pulling in some Walt Newton type connections in their storylines. For example, there was a story entitled "The Man of Bronze," which is a Laura Croft novel, and this story actually is Walt Newtonish in character. It actually involves supposedly a robot from the future that is made of bronze that is sent into the past and helps to solve crimes. I don't know whether you're familiar with it, but there are stories from the Middle Ages of a bronze head that was supposedly able to answer questions about the future. And it was supposedly one of the popes, I forget which one, was supposed to have had this head. And anyway, they kind of build that story on this legend. But it also tries to link up James Bond, Laura Croft, and a few other characters. I think Bulldog Drummond is also brought into it. So it's kind of a quasi-Walt Newton storyline. And these things are going to crop up. We wouldn't call them official.
Right.
They're just kind of just trying to expand the universe a little bit in their own way and expand some of the fun that you get with the Walt Newton speculation. Now, how about you, Paul? Do you have any that you have seen or noticed?
No, as far as I'm concerned, the canon is pretty much there on Wynn's site, and I'm comfortable with everything there. It's got a very strong American cultural bias, quite naturally, which sometimes doesn't resonate with me as much. But no, I don't. But I think echoing your point, Art, I think there are people out there who own Walt Newton type universe, and good luck to them.
That's part
of fun. People will always do that, and I'm not even sure Phil was necessarily the first person to do that kind of thing.
Yeah, like I mentioned before, you had Edgar S. Burroughs putting a couple of his characters together.
I think there are alternate universes, the Walt Newton universe.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I mean, we had mentioned before Operator 5, who obviously could not fit in most of the other universes.
Alternate Walt Newton universes. I like the idea of that.
Yeah, well, you know, I actually did a little piece on my blog about that, about trying to harmonize too much, you know, harmonizing versus concordism versus many worlds. And I really fall on the side of trying to see different worldviews. You know, for example, I think there are folks who have tried to include the Doc Caliban character from A Feast Unknown in the Walt Newton universe. And I think you'd have a hard time doing it because I think very clearly Doc Caliban and his five men were a surrogate for Doc Savage and his five men.
Right.
And I really don't have a problem with saying that this is an alternative universe. We know that the alternative universe idea is consistent with the math that we know of. In fact, I would make an argument. I've often thought about trying to get a story together where some kind of fictional character is trying to fight its way out of the fictional universe into the real universe.
Alternate universe idea. You know, Star Trek are doing it. Abrams is doing it with the new Star Trek franchise. It's now a new. They're going to develop in a certainly in a different way to the way they developed in the Roddenberry 60s classic series. And it's going to be a new Star Trek universe.
Yeah, they even admit in the movie itself that it is an alternate timeline.
Yep, you know, because of the time travel of Nero, things have changed. James Kirk lost his father at an early age, so he didn't have that influence that we traditionally know he had on the young James T. Kirk. So it's, you know, it's a different Kirk. It's a different set of people. There's obviously different dynamics going on in their relationships because they meet at different times.
Yeah, we mentioned... I was on my Star Trek episode. We talked quite a bit on that, you know, about the different Kirk. You know, how he's completely different from where his father was. I mean, you know, this... Well, the fact is, in the, that test... Where he goes through, you know, it's you're destined to fail. And the way he acts in his third attempt, where very nonchalant, it's like not even taking it serious.
No, you know, he knows he's cheating. He knows he's going to get caught cheating.
And the way he does is amazing.
You know, he was playing loose with his examiners.
And plus, he doesn't have the respect that, say, the Kirk who had his father grow up, you know, alive. You know, he don't have the respect, you know, he would have had, you know, with him. And, you know, this and here is like, hey, I didn't have nothing to do with Starfleet growing up. So, I mean, that'd be a different way. I mean.
Yeah. And you know, what's interesting is that, you know, of any of these fictional worlds that we have, the Star Trek world has got the largest fan base ever. And they know everything that everybody ever said in every show. And they got an explanation for every problem and not inconsistency between the different shows. I mean, if there's anyone who, if there's any show that has a strong fan base that wouldn't want you to tamper with it, it's Star Trek. Yet everybody has very well received the new Star Trek, because I think the storyline was well conceived and it was well executed. And in a
while to get on board with it, but with the program.
Yeah. Well, you know, I knew what Wynn was having. Wynn was practically foaming at the mouth.
when I felt a bit like that. But,
yeah. You know. He was livid because he's a big time Star Trek fan, and he actually is got very positive things to say about the new franchise. I think especially because they left the old continuity intact.
Exactly. We're spoiling this, you know, that movie completely, as I already did it before in my other episode, but because you have Leonard Nimoy as Spock, you know, as the older Spock, and he's still Spock in the movie. And at the very end, you have Leonard Nimoy, Spock, meeting Zachary Quinto, Spock. So, I mean, you have the two Spocks together.
Intrigued at how they're going to develop it, but as you say, you've already covered a lot of this ground. But
yeah.
You know, but just to illustrate the point, other, you know, alternate universes. Is it a plot device that works even there? So yeah, we can postulate different world mutant universes just as easily as different Star Trek universes.
Paul, we can barely hear you now.
Sorry.
Yeah. Now, you know, Paul, you said something earlier that I thought was interesting. You said that there's a very strong bias towards the American side in a lot of the Will Newton speculation, and I would agree with you on that. But is there anything in particular that you find peculiarly American?
That's a tough one. I mean, certainly I see a lot of espionage type. I don't know if that's an Anglo-centric view or if that stands up or not, but certainly that's what I see. There are lots of characters, lots of the American way, almost protecting the American way in a very, you know, very positive way, very supportive of that.
Yeah, but you know, that's part of it. Now, is there something that you would do differently in? You know, if you were going to take the Will Newton thing and run with it from a British perspective, would there be other things you'd want to include there?
I'd love to see more expansion into the classic English literary field. You know, the Jane Austen, you know, characters. I'd love to see much more of that, absolutely, because these are the characters that, you know, that I grew up with. You know, the Robert Louis Stevenson, I know some of them will predate, but, you know, Robert Louis Stevenson characters, you know, that would be fantastic. Mm. All of those great characters that I associate with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know, because I always find the initial Will Newton speculations, I thought, were very, they were very Anglophile, I thought. Because Farmer did that deliberately because, of course, he's dealing primarily around the British family. But the expansions that came out of it, I think you're right. They really were biased towards the American cultural end of things. And, you know, there are other characters. I always found myself gravitating towards British adventure fiction. You know, a little bit more, for example, of people like the Bulldog Drummond character, some of the stuff like the 39 Steps, John Buchan. Even, you know, there is the excellent stories about John Masters and his savage characters.
Right. I was thinking of the Flashman series as well.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Yes.
Yeah.
The Flashman series is just delightful.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Yes.
And that's just made for Will Newton. That was another... In a way, that kind of presaged it, because a lot of the Flashman stuff is using real characters and trying to juxtapose them.
Yeah, I mean, yes, he's a fictional hero or anti-hero, but yeah, absolutely, a great series of books, you know. And we lost Gordon Fraser MacDonald quite recently, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
Past. Yeah.
Oh,
now,
dear.
I was looking at some more of the names at the, you know, just on the very first page here. Now, there's a couple of them that kind of like. How do you fit this guy, this character in? And the obvious one I keep on flipping back to is Godzilla.
Godzilla?
Godzilla.
Where?
It's on the Winnecker, I mean, it's right, very first page.
Is it there?
It's right next to Captain America and Bucky. It says Godzilla, the men from Uncle, Doctor Who. It's like, how do you...
I can see it, yes, you're right.
I mean, you got all these other characters in there that I can, you know, I really have no problem with. Then all of a sudden you have Godzilla. Then you have the Ghostbusters. I'm kind of, you know.
Well, first of all, obviously Godzilla would have to be adopted.
Well, I can see, that it's not really a Will Newton character, but I mean, sort of like, how do you fit him into that universe?
Yeah, I see it there. It's there on the...
You know, and I, I'm only second guessing, but I'm assuming that that's Godzilla appears in a interacts with a character that is part of the Walt Newton universe, and by dint of that is mentioned there. I'm only speculating. We'd need to certainly ask Wynne about that, and I certainly will, because I mean that's intriguing.
Yeah,
I mean all the rest of these characters, like, I can see fitting in. I mean, they are human. I mean, they are, yeah, they're special human. You know, there's something most special about them, but they are still people that you can really see, that you can walk up and meet in person. You know, it's a possibility that they can exist.
You know, even if you go to Japan, you could meet Godzilla.
Yeah, you know,
there you go.
Like, how many times has Tokyo been destroyed by Godzilla?
what times we'd like to think? Well, you know, one of the interesting things, there was a comic book series called Planetary that came out about 10 years ago. And it actually had a crossover with the Godzilla and the Mothra characters into their own. Now, that was also a storyline that included Doc Brass and a group of characters that obviously were intended to exemplify, like, the Shadow and
Fu Manchu,
Swift, right, and all of those, and they included a version of Monster Island as part of their storyline, and that's how you got. There was a Mothra character, there was an obvious Godzilla character in it. It was very cutely done, and you know, I've got to blush and admit that I did a little piece over on my blog where I talked about this mysterious island that keeps cropping up somewhere in the Indian Ocean that's got dinosaurs and other strange animals on it, and how this could quite and including people like beings like King Kong, and that maybe this island is the source of several of these legends.
But is it the same island from Lost?
Oh. Right, yeah, well, that's an excellent question. I don't know. I'm still not quite sure. Lost loses me.
I haven't seen Lost in a while myself. But well, you know,
the island moves and it goes back and forth in time. So
yeah, that's why I've been here.
I'm not quite sure. But, I speculate in my website that maybe this is something that's being run by the Shoggoths, who are basically running a menagerie and running biological experiments, and they just keep throwing out different monstrous forms to see what they'll do.
Well, you know, it's like, to me, in Edgar Rice Burroughs, you know, the land, you know, in the Pellucidar series. Mm-hmm. And to me, on the Pellucidar, in the Pellucidar series, you know, you have complete whole world underneath the earth. But that's been proving, you know, that it could not exist. Well, I've always kind of, you know, had an idea is that maybe you go through a certain point and you're shifted off into another world. So, I mean,
well, you know, the story of the Hollow Earth actually has a very interesting history, because it was a belief that was held by a lot of people in the beginning of the 20th century who were in the Theosophical movement. And in fact, the Sun Ko character, the original German Sun Ko character, at the end of his run, he actually goes into the Hollow Earth and conquers Atlantis, which actually arose up into the Hollow Earth, and he's ruling on the inside of the Earth. The idea that the Earth itself is a hollow shell, it's a lovely thought, it doesn't work.
Right.
And we all know that. But that there could be caverns underneath the Earth that contain life and somehow have a method of sustaining it, well, that's always possible. And, you know, the possibility with Pellucidar is that it's not quite as extensive as Edgar Rice Burroughs had tried to make it. You know, one of the things Burroughs had in Pellucidar, which always struck me as utterly bizarre, is he had stegosauruses spreading their plates out and flying. Okay, which for a 5-ton animal... It's not bloody likely.
But it's different gravity in the center of the Earth.
There we go, of course.
Well, it's kind of like, with Tarzan.
I have a good, I have I've got a good friend who honestly believes that the Earth sits absolutely still and the entire universe revolves around it. And according to him, all the force of gravity changes as you get further away from the surface of the Earth, and that's why, geostationary satellites do not fall. And okay.
How many times was he dropped on his head? Has he had any kind of head injuries that you know of?
No. Well, but there are some people out there who have very strange ideas. And, well, there's an old joke that we tell in medicine about the guy who woke up one day and told his wife he was dead, so he didn't have to go into work and didn't have to pay any bills. And the wife takes him into the doctor and says, you gotta convince him that he's not dead. You know, we got bills to pay. He's got to go to work. So the doctor says to him, John, would you agree with me that dead men don't bleed? And John thought about this for a moment and says, yes, I think you're right. If you stuck a corpse with a pin, you wouldn't bleed. So the doctor then takes a pin and sticks John in the finger, and he starts to bleed profusely. And John looks down, and the doctor's smiling at him, and the doctor says, well, John, he said, you know, I guess dead men do bleed.
Yep, you believe what you want to believe.
Yes. Yeah. You know, that's the whole point. You know, it's if you're not willing to have your mind changed, there's nothing that's going to change it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if I was unwilling to have my mind changed, I would not be going for the Will Newton nail after, seeing a couple things that just didn't fit with me. But now, I mean, I'm one of these people that I think to myself, wait a minute, I've always been in, the mindset of a Will Newton universe where you can have the different characters, coincide with the others. Because it's not exactly a small planet. I mean, you could have, say, the Phantom be in Africa along with Tarzan, and they never meet. Or they can hear of each other, maybe, or something like that. Or, Quinn?
Yeah.
And, I think we agree. Yep.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's something I always like to say. I mean, I say, wait a minute. You start getting this Will Newton, universe idea going on. You can say, yeah, I would like to see something like Sherlock Holmes meeting. French Saberhagen wrote a book, The Holmes Dracula File.
Yeah.
And it's like, it fit good. I enjoyed it. I mean, I thought it was really nice. Now, some people kind of go overboard. They put Holmes that way, everything. It doesn't always work.
Well, very recently in the last 20 years, it's really pretty sad when you can say recently in the last 20 years. But there have been a lot of Sherlock Holmes pastiches, virtually all of which have been authorized by the copyright owners. And to be very frank, very early on in the 70s, some of them were pretty good. But more recent ones are less faithful to the character and have actually gone way off base. And I don't think they really do justice to the character. And it's a shame to me that they can just give that license away, basically for the money, without really, trying to hold to the standards that Arthur Conan Doyle put for his character. And not every pastiche is really worth the time reading it.
Oh, yeah.
That's why... I think something like, the Will Newton universe as Wynn has constructed it, somebody to kind of stand guard on it as for the official understanding of the Will Newton universe. I think that's very helpful, and it's necessary, because otherwise you just get mired down in all kinds of fruitless speculation, and the intention. I think there's a very positive intention for the whole idea of the Will Newton universe. It's an attempt to unify the characters of literature. And I'm a big fan of this concept of the hero and the importance of the hero in not only in literature but really in human life. The Will Newton storyline is about people who are larger than life, who are heroic characters, some of them heroically good, some of them heroically bad, like the Moriartys, but it's exploring, this whole idea of what makes a hero, and I think there's somewhat of a moral basis to it. You know, the idea that society is somehow orderly and that there are going to be those who are the standard bearers for certain values, you know, pro and con. You know, one thing about Phil Farmer, Phil was a little bit of an iconoclast, as anybody who's read his books will know. But Phil never lost the sense of what a hero was. There are no anti-heroes in Phil Farmer's works. They're all real heroes. These are people who have made a moral decision to do X and to stand for X, and they stand for it. And they do so because they are able to do it, they know why they're doing it, and they stand on principle. And this is an important part, I think, of what he was trying to do with the Walt Newton universe. He was gathering together in his own mind all of these influences from literature, because Phil probably read more books than I possibly can imagine. I just am amazed at the breadth of his knowledge in the literature, and I think that he was getting all of these influences and trying to link them together to get some kind of a cohesive picture, a worldview that made sense. And in every Phil Farmer story, you know, he has great moral conscience. You know, his morality sometimes is not terribly conventional, but it is consistent. And, you know, that's one thing that I owe to Phil Farmer. You know, one thing I've always appreciated about him is that I appreciate the idea of real heroism and what it means to be a real hero.
Hear, hear.
I agree with it.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, when we talked about earlier, you know, how the Sherlock Holmes, you know, you have all these different versions of him. Now, another example is Fu Manchu. I had done an interview with the, you know, with Bill Maynard, who done the latest Fu Manchu novel.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And he said he's the second person who's been authorized by the, you know, Sex Romer estate to write anything. I mean, they shoot down anybody who thinks about writing on Fu Manchu without permission.
Yeah, I think Kay Van Esch was the last one.
Yeah, he's the only other one beside Bill.
Yeah.
And they fit into the Fu Manchu universe very well. I mean, I read his, you know, Terror of Fu Manchu, you know, before we did our interview. And it's like, I, you know, this is the first time I ever got to read the Fu Manchu novels. I read the first two, then I didn't get a chance to get into the third one yet because I was, you know, in a bit of a rush. And I read his, and it's like, whoa, this guy knows his, you know, how to do the Fu Manchu and fit in. That's what I like when somebody who's willing to, you know, fit their view by copying, by honoring the original. And like I said, you know, I see, you know, good examples, you know, like with the Sherlock Holmes, I've seen parts where it's like, he's Sherlock Holmes in name only. And there's several of them, you know, that, the story might be good, but it's not the Sherlock Holmes I read.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean.
Yeah.
Well, that's why having someone to set the standard is very important. And, you know, these stories have a legacy. They are a time capsule in many ways of that period in history when this type of literature arose. It was for popular consumption, and in many ways it reflected the popular mores of the time and some of the popular ideas of the time. And in a sense, it was also trying to, you know, this was happening during the Depression, during a lot of turbulent periods in early 20th century history. This shaped opinions. You know, what we're seeing when, you know, I know this because one of the things I did in high school when I was rereading the Doc Savage reprints, try and link up some of these stories with the time period in which they were actually published. I did this. There was one Doc Savage story. The title was The Czar of Fear, which was written in the late 33, just about a year after Roosevelt had gotten into office. And Roosevelt had enacted a number of things in order to try and stimulate the economy and get hope going with the people. And the Czar of Fear was basically having Doc Savage do something similar in a town that had come on very hard economic times. And it was really, if you read it properly, it was an apology for the New Deal and for some of the New Deal's programs. And if you knew the time period in which it was written, it became very obvious. I happened to be studying that particular period in high school. So, you know, it's important, I think, to understand that this literature in context. Now, we're not just talking about good stories and fun stories, because they are that, and that's what really got me interested in many of them. But these are also stories that are reflecting something else deeper. They're coming from somewhere else, and they're meeting some kind of a need, and that's the reason why they become popular with people.
Yeah. To kind of hit back on, you know, the reason why we're talking on the Wold Newton, you know, is really to, you know, to show people what this thing is and to, you know, give people an idea. It's not exactly just anybody could be thrown in there. You have to be a certain character, and it has to actually fit. You can't throw in your average comic book character into the Wold Newton.
No, absolutely.
No.
You have to be really a human being. You have to be, you know, one of the literary characters. Now, you can be a little, you know, to the extreme of, you know, the, you know, like a very, like a Doc Savage. But you can't be, say, like the Flash. You know? He wouldn't work. But it's like I was reading a deal where they're talking about him, you know, the Doc Savage character coming into DC Comics now.
Oh, Lord, I saw that, yeah.
And they said he'd have to be in his own universe because Doc Savage is the Superman of his universe. If you put him with the Superman of the DC Comics, then Doc Savage is just a regular person. He's not human. I mean, he's not the ultimate. So, I mean,
Well, that's the whole point. The Doc Savage character was supposed to emulate what the Superman would be like. Something that, you know, in all honesty, I don't think that Lester Dent really tried to pull off. Dent was very subtle in the way he was pulling it off. And I think the level of... the level of understanding of, okay, what is it really like to be a Superman among people who are not Supermen? That would be an interesting storyline. Somebody who did kind of play with that idea was Philip Wiley.
Yeah, I just forgot when you say that.
Yeah, you know, and I think Philip Wiley, in many ways, he kind of appreciated, you know, his idea. He's more of the direction I would have liked to seen some of the Doc Savage stories go. You know, really exploring some of that extreme stuff. You know, Phil Farmer tried to do some of that in some of his pastiche work and in his own stories. But we never really have gotten a good storyline for the Superman. You know, what I'd really love to see would be the storyline of the two great Supermen in the Wold Newton universe are Tarzan and Doc Savage, mm-hmm. one typifying the man of civilization and the other typifying man in his natural state. Mm-hmm. And seeing those characters interacting in their environment a little more realistically and then having them interact again with each other. Now, Phil did a little of that with A Feast Unknown. And, you know, he pulled off some of those, but even he kind of shied back from, I think, a much more in-depth psychological study. You know, that just shows you where my mind is going. I want to see a little bit more depth psychology on this to see exactly where this would go. How far can you push it? You know, is the Superman going to really be naturally Nietzschean? Is he going to be less concerned with the concerns of the herd? You know, would somebody who actually considered himself to be genetically and morally superior worry about petty things like crime? You know, there's another author, Olaf Stapledon,
mm.
Have you
I've read a few of his books? Yeah, I've read First and Last Men and a couple of other Sirius.
Sirius. Okay, Sirius and Odd John are the two books that come to mind. Because, you know, Odd John is really exploring, okay, the next stage in evolution. And you know, and Stapledon, he was a philosopher. I forget where he taught. But if you've read Last and First Men?
Yeah, that is superb. Yes.
Yes, and Star Maker. Have you read that?
I've not read Star Maker, no.
Okay. Star Maker actually is a much larger novel that encompasses some of the stuff from Last and First Men and brings the entire beginning and end of the universe. And I'll tell you what, two things. Number one, every science fiction plot in the 20th century, every science fiction plot in the 20th century is in Star Maker. It's all there. Everybody has copied Stapledon. In fact, the one man who I think is most guilty of virtual plagiarism on Stapledon's ideas is Robert Heinlein. His Martians in Stranger in a Strange Land and in his other Mars novels are basically Last Men. If you look at them. Stapledon is somebody who has been, I think, underappreciated. But, you know, I read those stories back in 1968-69. Did a lot of reading in those days. And, you know, I realized at that point that every major Star Trek story that I had seen had somehow been a chip off of this Olaf Stapledon idea. It was all in Star Maker. There's a lot more. But Stapledon covers a lot of this. You know, Sirius is the story of a dog that develops intelligence. This is a non-human intelligence and how it will interact with humans. Then Odd John is about the super intelligent humans, the next stage in that evolution. And you go through this whole gamut. Stapledon did a novel about each one of these ideas, and he's also somebody that is really worth reading. I mean, you could do a whole career just going through Stapledon's stuff and characterizing it.
Yeah, I mean, I think Last and First Men is good books. It's absolutely, its breadth is phenomenal.
Sounds like we could do an episode just on that one author.
I'm going to read Star Maker now.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
I've got it. It's on that shelf of the to read.
Right.
So it's there. Kind of like I have this one book of. Adam Link Robots by E. Ando Binder.
By Yando Binder.
Yeah.
Well, okay. No, what's the title of it?
Adam Link Robots.
Adam Link. Oh, yeah. Yeah. The Adam Link stories. I first ran into them on the old One Step Beyond. Not One Step Beyond. What is it? The Outer Limits.
The Outer Limits, yeah.
And they remade it for the new Outer Limits programs out of Canada. In the first Outer Limits program where they did it was a brief version of the first section of Adam Link. These stories were actually written around 1939, 1940. And they were serialized in a magazine. In fact, I've actually gotten, somebody has put them up online, and I've got a downloaded set of them. But anyway, in the first story that was done for The Outer Limits, Leonard Nimoy plays a newspaper man in that episode. In the recent episode that was done just a few years ago, Leonard Nimoy plays the attorney defending Adam Link. So he kind of connects back to that story, which is interesting.
And Adam Link in that last one looks actually like a real person. Mm-hmm. If I remember right, it's been a while since But I haven't picked up this, you know, the paperback. It's an old 50-cent cover price.
Oh yeah, yeah. I remember reading that. See, they reprinted a lot of these things back in the '60s, and then later on, they got some things in the '70s. That's where I picked many of them up. And I devoured all that stuff. You know, I remember always hearing about Gladiator by Philip Wiley. That was mentioned several times. And they didn't reprint that until the mid-70s. And I read that one when I was in medical school. Very, very moving story. They made a terrible movie with Joey Brown, made it into a comedy. And I can imagine Philip Wiley must have wanted to strangle himself. You know, what are the things? I'd love to be a fly on the wall when Philip Wiley and Phil Farmer would get together to talk shop. I would love to be there because the two of them, I think, had very similar concerns and styles. And I think that would have been a very interesting conversation.
Well, I just think about earlier, you know, the Philip Wiley Gladiator character. Mm-hmm. It would have been interesting if we could see, you know, him, he's a Superman.
Yep.
If you get somebody else, say the Shadow or something like that, as your Batman, and just get all the different, you know, characters, say from pulp and literature, and make your own, you know, Justice Society or Justice, you know, League.
Right.
And to see how different, if you really, you know, follow the character, you know, their personalities.
I mean, well, in a way, it's been done. It was called Watchmen.
You know, I was just about to say that.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I see the thing is, you know, they're a little bit different on the characters. But I mean, you don't really, you know, if you was, you know, say, take those certain characters and put them in, I mean, they'd even be completely different from the Watchmen. Because, I mean, Philip Wiley's, you know, Gladiator would be a lot different from, say, Dr. Manhattan. Although, would you say he'd be more the Ozymandias?
Well, no, Ozymandias is a little bit too cerebral. The thing about Hugo Danner was that Hugo Danner, he wasn't a great thinker. He just kind of plus he was an ordinary guy who just happened to be super strong and invulnerable, and he kind of blundered through life doing various things and never really being able to fit in with his abilities.
So I mean, he'd be a lot more different than say like a Clark Kent, completely different. I mean, the only thing they have in common is the strength and invulnerability.
Oh yeah. Well, yeah, this would be similar to Jim comparing Doc Savage and Jim Anthony.
Right.
Paul, are you familiar with Jim Anthony?
No, I'm not.
Okay, Jim Anthony is another one of the B level pulp characters that we had in the United States. Except he was supposed to be a Doc Savage clone. Except that Jim Anthony was in what we called euphemistically the spicy pulps. The ones that had all these scantily clad women in them, and he was not somebody who wasn't influenced by a pretty face. Let's put it that way.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah. So, you know, that's I've often toyed with the idea of Doc Savage meeting Jim Anthony. You know, because everybody makes jokes about Superman as the Boy Scout in blue. You know, and again, with a real person who really does come to Earth with powers and abilities far greater than those of mortal men, you know, exactly how do you deal with that?
Well, it depends on, you know, if they would have had him as a Clark Kent growing up the way he did, you know, from a baby.
Mm-hmm.
I don't, you know, I could see him be similar to what, you know, what we see now. You know, to the Clark Kent, but if you really have him that powerful as a baby.
Yeah, well, hey, man, do you have teenagers?
Well, I got grandkids are teenagers.
Okay, I was going to say, have you been through the whole teenage thing with children?
Oh, yeah, I've seen it.
You see, you know, I often wondered why it was that alligators, when they become adolescents, that you can't find them anymore. And that's because the male alligators will eat them.
Yeah.
When you have teenagers, you understand why.
I've got that yet to come, then.
Oh, yeah. Oh, your girls are adorable. Hopefully they'll stay that way forever.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed.
I hope so.
What you do is you lock them up when they become teenagers, and you when they're ready to go to college, you can unlock them.
Yeah. Oh, you let them out.
Hold a decent conversation.
That's right. But you know, because I'll tell you what. A teenager who really was going through a crisis, an angst crisis, who was different. I mean, wow. And here's a teenager who is allegedly different and can't tell anybody about it. I mean, you're talking about having somebody who's going to be virtually schizophrenic. You know, the Superman stories are very optimistic about the possibilities of, you know, good, clean living and growing up on a farm. I think probably a little bit too optimistic about how easy that would all have been for somebody put in that situation. You know, that would be one. You see, if Phil were still with us in his vigor, he might actually have tried to tackle that one.
Well, DC has done their version of what I would say is a more realistic Superboy teenager in the character of Superboy Prime. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know kept up with the new stuff, but he is not exactly Mr. Sweetness and Charm.
No.
He is very much the brat. I mean, it's like, if it didn't go his way, you better not be around the neighborhood because he'll probably kill you. You know, either by accident or on purpose.
Yeah.
I mean, I can see him more as a realistic Superman. You know, as a teenager. You know, things are not going his way. He's going to strike out.
Yeah, but you know, and part of it, that rebellious phase is also part of normal maturation. Because, in a way, every kid has got to break the apron strings. Every kid has got to be able to break away, make their own choices and their own decisions. You know, that's the whole part of growing up. If they don't do that, in fact, you end up with children who are not able to take their place in the world. So, that, you know, a certain degree of that rebelliousness, that unrest is something natural. You've got to expect that. But, you know, therein lies the tale of what's it like if you are exceptional, mm-hmm. and you are going to be thrown loose in the world. What is it going to be like to be that exceptional person and having to deal with it? And how, you know, how do you get past your adolescence without somebody wanting to strangle you? There are times. But, you know, by the same token, you know, there are some people who don't get through that and who are not able to break the strings, are not able to handle things on their own, and you end up with disasters, which is, you know, we see them every day, you know. Boy, I could tell you stories.
But, you know, some
people, it makes me think of that character Dexter.
Yes.
Yes.
The support structure he has. It's his father who channels it very carefully into this kind of force for good, you know, in some weird way.
Yeah.
Because, you know,
a serial killer who hunts serial killers.
Yeah, you know, is a force for good in a way. You know, how mixed up can you get? But, you know, what to me comes through is his father's influence and the rules that his father sets that channels Dexter through his teenage years. You know, mm-hmm. I guess, again, any different character, whether that's exceptional strength or intellect, it's just around how that's channeled and the people around who would influence that. And I always thought of Superman as, you know, I think the story wanted to get to him being an adult so that he could do all these amazing things, but that family concept was quite strong. You know, he had those two surrogate parents for at least a good chunk of his childhood.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought that that's what, you know, gave him that moral backbone.
Yeah, you know, if you always look at it, the kids are the ones who are, you know, the ones that everybody goes and reference to who Superman is now. Mm. It's, you know, growing up with Jonathan and Martha Kent.
Yeah.
And it's like,
they were the parents he knew.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, if you grew up with Jor-El and Lara, I mean, depending what version you're looking at,
yeah,
he would be completely different.
Yeah. Well, I know in the TV show, they kind of imply that Jor-El was not necessarily all that much of a nice guy and didn't have all those... He wasn't being very altruistic by sending his son to Earth, that he actually intended his son to be able to take over.
kind of wonder at times, you know, it sort of flip-flops at times.
Yeah.
Know, where they're going to have them at. Yeah.
But, you know, but that's always, you know, the heroic character is always of, you know, it's always fascinating to me for that reason, because of the mystery of, you know, what the character is, where the character comes from, what motivates him. You know, why does he do the things that he does? The anti-hero has been, you know, that was a very popular concept back in the 60s and 70s, and I never really got into it because it seemed to me that the anti-hero really went nowhere and did things for no really decent reason. And as I said, I think one of the things that Phil gave us was a strong sense of heroism, and heroism really is moral choice. Your ability to make choices and to live with them and to abide by them. But you know, that's, I think many of the people I've known who have an interest in the pulp characters, and you know, in the heroic fiction generally, I think a lot of them have got this strong sense of, you know, the you know, doing things the right way and emulating the hero. I think that's what attracts people to this kind of literature, and I think that you know, the people that I've met who are interested in the heroic literature, this is something that.
Oh yeah. Well, we've been going on for almost 2 hours now.
Oh heavens! Yeah. I told, well, you know, you just throw a soapbox, it's all over. Told you.
Yeah, you know, I think we pretty much given everybody an idea, and you give me more an idea, you know, more of a you know, kind of a basis of what the Walt Newton universe really is. You know, I said what I've always, you know, what little I've seen of it before this here, where it's like, wait a minute, I just saw the things I did not like at times. Mm-hmm. But there is a lot of stuff in it that I do like. And a lot of things that does make sense. I mean, it, you know, explains a lot more. Like Tarzan and his son and stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, having Wynn on again sometime to talk about that would be, you know, a great idea.
Oh, yeah. You know,
sometime down the line.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Wynn and I have talked about it. You know, he's pretty busy at this moment. That's why he wasn't able to be on here at this time.
Right.
But I do plan on having him on here again. You know, we talk some more Walt Newton on there. I mean, this is a subject that we can just keep on going. I mean, there's tons of different things that I haven't even brought up about on questions.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and, you know, there will be more publications coming very shortly. We are expecting, most from Monkey Brain Press, we're supposed to have a large encyclopedia of the pulps coming out from Justin Evans, the librarian and historian.
I mentioned that in one of my episodes.
Yeah, that's going to be a major work. It's, you know, I have his Victorian listing, which is it's almost like a Fiat parts catalog.
What?
It's so huge. There's so many different things in it. And we're going to be seeing that published soon. I know that there's a crossovers book that Wynn has in the works. That's going to be dealing with, you know, the crossovers within the Walt Newton universe and, you know, showing some of these different connections. He's already published a couple of things, Myths for the Modern Age, again from Monkey Brain Press. That's got some of his stuff in it. And our friend Rick Lai, I don't know whether Rick is going to make it to PharmaCon this year, but Rick is another walking encyclopedia. The man has read everything since the 18th century in French and English. And Rick has published two volumes now out of Lulu. His name, well, actually, I think it's Rick Lai. It's L-A-I. I think it's pronounced Lai. And Rick has two books out from there, plus that are essays of his, some of them from online and some of them that are, you know, original. And those essays also are, they're very relevant to this. The last one was Criminal Masterminds. They just published it about a month ago. A lot of Doc Savage stuff in there. There's also some Fu Manchu stuff and some Tarzan stuff. Very important. Rick also has done some things on The Shadow as well. He's got a Shadow book, too. So he's got three books out.
I think he did something on the chronology of the Shadow.
Yeah, he did the chronology of the Shadow, and Rick also has one of the chronologies on Doc Savage. The other one is from Jeff Deicher. Jeff just upgraded his, and his is available now also from Lulu, I believe. Yeah, that's right. And Rick's chronology, there's at least two written versions of it, and I've got it on disc as well, a CD version. The CD version is very helpful because you can go do it searches, which is wonderful. But, you know, we've had a lot of things published in the Wold Newton. And, you know, one of the people we do have to mention, which we haven't mentioned, is Peter Coogan, who is over here at Fontbonne University here in St. Louis. He has written a book on the hero, the superhero, and he's another expert in Wold Newton universe. He has his theory of these different circles of depth into the Wold Newton universe, which, you know, we ought to get Peter on here one day to explain that, because he actually teaches courses on this stuff.
I just get a hold of him, and we'll see about putting him on here.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Yeah. So anyway, but this is, you know, this is fun stuff. You know, it makes me very happy because I've been obsessed with this stuff for the last, you know, 35 to 40 years, thinking that I was the only one out there. You know, the internet is an amazing amazing tool. It brings a lot of people together who otherwise would never have found each other.
Oh yeah, I mean, if it wasn't for that, I would never even have known the two of you.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah, you know, I couldn't agree more. You know, if it wasn't for the internet, I would never have met Phil Farmer. I wouldn't have made all these friends I've made through that type of universe of just doing things like this is fantastic.
And, you know, that's the, you know, Phil has been such an iconic figure for me over the years. You know, it was wonderful to be able to meet him last year. You know, he really wasn't in very good shape at the time, but you know, these things without that, without the internet, without all these interactions, I don't know. You know, it just makes life more fun.
Yeah, for, you know. Plus, I wouldn't be able to do the podcast like this year. And
that's right.
I had all the more things that I always wanted to know about. Yeah. But I guess we better go ahead and close before we even have enough for another show.
Sounds good.
But thank you for asking me on, Rick. I've really enjoyed it, and good to talk to you too, Art.
Hey, same here, Paul. I'm looking forward to seeing. By the way, I meant to ask you, Spiteri, you wouldn't happen to be Italian, would you?
No, it's Maltese name.
Ah, okay. Very interesting.
A little bit south of Italy.
Yeah, a little bit. Hey, Malta's not a bad place.
No, it's a lovely place. I love it.
Beautiful.
I mean,
yes.
I must admit, I've never lived there, but I've been there many, many times.
Super.
All right, well, thanks for both of you guys being on, and if you want to go ahead and just hold on a second, and then I'll go ahead and end this. Okay. All right, thank you, and we'll talk to you guys later. Bye.